Your job is to tell the truth. That's your job as a journalist. And if you can't do that, you're in the wrong job.
That it wasn't my job, that it isn't our job to be popular.
It was interesting to me how they fit together as a book. I mean, I'm not nearly smart enough to have done that on purpose.
I jumped four floors in college into a laundry truck. I would jump five floors off a hotel balcony into a swimming pool. I was really not completely sane when I look back on it.
Hi all, it's episode 50 of Behind the Lines here on The 42 with me, Gavin Cooney. This week's guest is US sports writer Roland Lazenby. Roland is author of more than 50 books, including acclaimed biographies of Kobe Bryant and of Michael Jordan. He's also a teacher, and as you're going to hear, he was on the Virginia Tech campus in April 2007 on the appalling day a student committed the deadliest school shooting in US history. That is all to come in a moment, but a quick reminder, you can indeed get in touch with the show. Email behindthelines@the42.ie. You can tweet me, I'm at GCUNY93, or you can join the WhatsApp group by following the details in the episode description of this show. Thank you so much for your support in allowing us to get 50 episodes of this podcast. We love doing the show, and it's only possible thanks to your generous support. So let us get on with the 50th episode. Here is our conversation with Roland Lazenby. So, Roland, for the benefit of our Irish listeners, and forgive this rather inelegant question, but for the benefit of our Irish listeners who may not be aware of you, can you tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do?
I am a sports biographer, and that is a job that I reached after a long journey, being first a high school coach and then becoming a sports writer and working for newspapers and then being a news writer, not even in sports. And then my old man, my father, was a very serious basketball guy. I liked football and played it. I even played in college for a year, but or in university, I should say, to probably is clearer. But my father was a nut, and he died while I was a news writer. And he died a slow, hard death with brain cancer. And it really ignited in me. I had always played pickup basketball and enjoyed it, but I started playing constantly. And right at that time, I not only was I working like 60 hours a week as a news writer, I was a night police reporter covering crime and all sorts of mayhem. But I started graduate writing school in a writing program at Hollins University. In the first class, the first day, the instructor said, if you're going to be a writer, you should think about writing a book. And so in class, I took out a notepad, and one of the few things I'd learned as an undergrad, I was just a bad student, but I had learned about divergent thinking. So I just made a quick list of the things I could write a book about. And number seven on that list was a basketball book that was unfolding in Virginia. This was in 1981. Ralph Sampson was at the University of Virginia. He was a big center in American college basketball, went on to play in the NBA, but I wrote a book about him. And that sort of launched my career. And I didn't really understand the whole father-son thing until I did my Jordan biography, Michael Jordan, The Life, which came out in 2014. And really the influence that that father-son relationship has on the son. It is often dramatic and profound, as it was for Michael, and it was for me. I spent my life writing largely basketball books. And as I moved into biography, because biography is really where you have the room to write, you have the budget to write, you get paid well to write them. You get to provide all sorts of cultural context. So while you're writing about basketball, you're not just writing about basketball. You're writing about race and business and culture. And so it was just a very comfortable place for me to be. And it also coincided with my career experience writing lesser books, sometimes coffee table books, sometimes just books about a season about American professional basketball. I had done a lot of that, writing about the NBA. But I'd spent time, I'd done a lot of projects with and about the Bulls, the Lakers, the Celtics, and then various other teams. So that became the field, the great vast experience for me to draw upon to write my biography.
There's loads to chat about there, but I do want to briefly go back to, you mentioned you were a high school coach. What did you coach?
Wrestling. I was a varsity wrestling coach, and at age 23. And before that, I'd coached a year of football. Football not being soccer, but being American football. And I had played 3 years of rugby in college after a year of football. You know, in football, you wear the helmet in America. In rugby, you don't wear the helmet. And so, but I went to Virginia Military Institute, where in physical education, we had a very substantial course in boxing and wrestling. And then on the rugby team, I mean, we just wrestled all the time. You know, it was... Wrestling was, I don't know, you'd show up to practice and there'd always be somebody coming up and grabbing you, and the next thing you know, it's a 5-minute tussle and who's going to put who on the ground and that kind of stuff. And so I was very comfortable wrestling, and the high school where I got hired needed a wrestling coach and they needed an English teacher, and it was at the last minute and I could do both, and it was a wonderful, wonderful experience for me that really got my life headed in the right direction.
And then you left it.
I did. I left to take a minimum wage job as a sports writer because one opened. I had wanted to, you know, there's no internet back then. It was all typing on a typewriter. There was a little bit of computer set type, but as a result, there was no internet. There weren't a lot of jobs of any kind in newspaper work. And my wrestling team ended up being a championship team. And so I had to do a lot of interviews. I would talk about my wrestlers, hoping they could get scholarships. And they even asked me to write an article about my team. So I did. So they liked that article, and wrestling season was over and all the spring sports were going on. And so they asked me to write articles, and lo and behold, the sports editor resigned that summer. And so they offered me the job at $2.40 an hour. And, you know, I was only making like $9,000 a year as a full-time English teacher and coaching wrestling 6 days a week. So I got into the newspaper business and, you know, made great progress there, learned a lot, but I really wanted to do longer form narrative. And I wanted to, you know, I was an ambitious guy. I got a late start. One of the things that happened in there, I got diagnosed with a brain aneurysm and spent 10 days in the hospital when I was 24. And the doctors couldn't figure it out. And they tried everything, but this is in 1977. And they didn't have the technology to further diagnose. So finally they said, we could give you one more test, but if we do, it might cause a stroke. So we're just going to release you. But I had been in the hospital for a day when my doctor came in and said, you know, you're about to have your first bleed, and there's a 30% mortality rate on your first bleed. And so you need to get your things in order, because you got about a a 30% chance you could pass here in the next 24 hours. And that got my attention. Not much got my attention in those days. And so when they couldn't diagnose me, my wife picked me up and we had to drive a half hour back to our place. I had a year old child. I said, screw this. I got to find out if I'm healthy or not. And I was in great shape back then. So I went and ran 5 miles and everything was fine. So
are you going for this run being like, I'm going to run here and there is a chance I'll collapse?
Oh, I didn't think of it that way. I thought I'd get it all clear. But yeah, no, that was there. But I, you know, I've never been a, when I got old, I became fearful. I was nervous about, I was claustrophobic on small planes when I'd travel. But outside of that, I really never had a lot of fear. I've never really, you know, I've pulled all kinds of stunts in my life, but I just had no physical fear of things. I don't know, but I think that really helped me make progress as a writer. Because if I got everything I could out of a situation, I would just change gears and move on. And that would always make my wife a little crazy because we had a family pretty quickly. But I don't know. I look back at my life and wonder how and why I was like that, but I have been.
Hmm.
And then, so I just said, I'm going to go run and find out. I do not like not having the answers.
Yeah. And then you made a move into sports writing. And that, as you say, was probably encouraged by your dad or encouraged by what you thought your dad would have wanted.
Dad at that time wasn't real pleased. I left a full-time job to go work in the newspaper industry. But I mean, he wasn't trying to control my life. He just said, you know, you got to think about this stuff. But I had had that diagnosis. And it was the kind of experience where I said, well, what do you want to do with your life? And I had gotten involved. I never would have, if you had looked at me as a young man, even through most of college, and said, oh, you're going to be a sports biographer or you're going to be this or that. I would never have had any thought of that. Would never, it would have been, you might as well have told me I was going to be Marco Polo or something. It was not part of my format. And so, but once that happened, once I had that diagnosis and I became a writer, and then my father had brain cancer and I would work till, you know, from 3 p.m. to 1 p.m. in the night shift at the paper. And then I would go over to the hospital and sit up with him where he was suffering. And, you know, I was just deeply affected. People are deeply affected by such things every day. But that was my moment to feel that. And it was like rocket fuel. I didn't understand what an impact fatherly disapproval can have on a young male until I really got into the nuts and bolts of Jordan's life. And by then I'm 60 years old looking back on my own life and I've got 60 some basketball books I've written and I'm going, damn, all of this was because my old man, he loved me. He was a good guy, but he did not approve of me in any way. He could not figure me out. And so we were at odds. And Michael's father came to love him dearly, but the hard wiring in life with Michael, it's like he was trying to show his old man, you know, and it's an unspoken thing. It's all done by action and it's keyed and it's a powerful thing.
Was there much regret on your part when you were doing the Jordan book that you couldn't turn around to your dad and say, I get this now?
No, I, you know, I don't visit a whole lot of regret. Certain people have a certain bone. I never had a lot of fear in my life. I jumped four floors in college into a laundry truck. I would jump five floors off a hotel balcony into a swimming pool. I was really not completely sane when I look back on it. But these were larks to me, you know. It's just stupid stuff I did. I could go, the list could go on. But I also have never, I really didn't experience fear till I got older. And I have some regrets now, but pardon me, never much along the way. I would just, you know, I just didn't have that emotion or that inclination to regret things. My life was always pretty busy, moving fast, and I was amused. You know, I just didn't. I did write a book for my old man. His favorite player was Jerry West, the American basketball player who was for the Lakers, who became the general manager of the Lakers, and now has been a great consultant and personnel man all over American professional basketball. He's a hero. And I wrote a book about Jerry West for ESPN Books in 2010. And I wrote that for my old man and put a copy on his grave.
How did that must have been a very affecting experience as well then.
Pretty much. Yeah, it was. I think that's the way you deal with things. I also don't spend a lot of time trying to know the ultimate reality. I know what I know. I know what I can know, and I don't pretend to know the other things. I have intuition about things, but I try to keep fact and intuition, you know, in separate drawers of the desk.
You've written, as we have talked about, an acclaimed 800-odd page biography of Michael Jordan, Michael Jordan, The Life. What do you know about him? Tell us about the Jordan that you know.
Oh, wow. You know, that was the wonderful thing. In the 90s, I spent a lot of time writing and working around the Bulls. And just the most exciting time in my life in terms of work. I was there for the Last Dance season, but I was there the previous six seasons. And Jordan was just a tremendously charismatic figure. He was, he mesmerized entire groups of people in person. And then through media, he mesmerized millions upon millions upon millions around the globe. I mean, come on, American professional basketball, who gave a shit? It was just not something that interested the globe in any major way. And there were some things that changed that. The NBA very smartly changed some of its business practices. It began dumping games into European markets, where a place like some small European country couldn't afford to put on soccer games, but it could afford to run NBA games. And so there were things like that to prime the pump. But here came Jordan with all this global marketing. That was fine, but it was the way he played. And as much as I admired The Last Dance, the one thing it really didn't capture, and the one thing that's very hard to capture, is what it was like to watch him play. And it was like that from the very first time I watched him in person to the last, and what he could bring into a building. Now that translated, you could see it on TV if you really wanted to sit there and watch. And as TV production got better and better, you could see it better and better. But when you were in the building, and I'd seen a lot of basketball by the time I really got work for with and about the Bulls. And I'd seen Michael a lot, and there, and I'd seen all the great ones. And believe me, I'm writing a biography now of Magic Johnson. He had that great, tremendous charisma and high energy approach. He was unbelievable. And Larry Bird in his own way, those were the three great players. There were many, many, many very, very good ones, but the three truly great were Jordan and Magic and Bird of the 80s, which was, it was the Camelot period of American basketball, pro basketball. It was unbelievable. It was before all the suits in the NBA started jimmying with the rules of the game and changed it all around so that they could maximize their profits. And they've done well. I mean, it's made it even more popular in their, until the pandemic and their argument with China, they were making more money than God could print. But the 80s was really a magical time, bleeding over into the 90s, of course, with Jordan. And so that charisma of Michael Jordan, and then the way he, you know, he could have been at the podium, he put on those great suits. And the PR director for the Bulls called all the media, and by the, I mean, the media was just 20 deep around him. TV crews everywhere, everybody crowding in. And Tim Hallam, the PR director, longtime PR director for the Bulls, a very earthy guy, he called all those media scrums the pig fuck. And so to watch Jordan, he could have, they would encourage him to, when he put on those $1,000 suits, to go up at the podium and talk in a dignified manner. But he wanted right in the middle of the pig fuck. And it was like this very intense thing. All these people drawing, they were hanging on every word, every sort of recording device or notebook or camera, all of it pressed up there. And he wanted to be in that.
He enjoyed that, do you think? Did he?
Oh, I think it was part of who he was. I think that, I'm not a psychiatrist or even a decent psychologist, but I think that was part of his charisma. He would take this giant spectacle and bring it off the stage, and instead of being withdrawn and standoffish, he was right there in the middle of it. And those reporters could look each other in the eye and talk. And it was, you don't get that today.
No,
definitely everything was so managed from a public relations standpoint. There's none of that. It is all such a, such a spate of process pablum. It is, back then there was a very raw and real element to post-game news conferences for the Bulls. And Michael, most of the time, would have done something pretty spectacular in that game. Something would have happened. It might not always be legendary. You wouldn't know that today, because every single thing the guy ever did, they've made into a legendary moment. I mean, there've been some, we are a human culture that really loves celebrity. Really, really, really love athletic celebrity. And we really, 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 really love a select few of those celebrity athletes. I just think Michael told 2008, I was sitting with him up in an arena in Orlando, just the two of us talking. And I'd asked him about his life, and he told me timing is everything. And that was really the story of his life. He had this perfect time. He came along right when everything was blowing up in this global marketing sense, when the NBA was moving out of the backwater into the foreground, He came along right when the first African-American male was being made the centerpiece of all these marketing campaigns, from Nike to Gatorade to never been done before. Not really anywhere near that level. He was moving in right as he was reaching his apex as a competitor. And his journey mattered. And you know, some kids in Africa or Estonia, or they were wearing t-shirts. You know, the NBA was dumping all these games for free, and the way it got paid for them was its merchandising sales went from a couple hundred million to a couple of billion, and I mean, it just ka-ching, 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 it just, you know, and he was like this living, breathing clothes horse.
But celebrity is the business model. I know you say it's a culture that likes celebrity, but from the way you described it there, that was the business model. You know, that's how you sell... You make these guys celebrities so they can sell merchandise.
It's how you sell newspapers, TV shows. It's how you sell clothing. It's how you sell cologne. I mean, he went through the whole list of products. And those who came before him were very envious of him because he was able to do that.
And sorry, that's interesting when you say that's how you sell newspapers. So can you distinguish that between the biographer's job?
My proposals are obviously literary proposals. By the way, the name of my Jordan proposal, it opened with this section called the pig fuck. And so you have to have this very powerful sense of, you know, where you're coming from a literary standpoint, but you also have to have all the marketing work and explain that. Because all of these editors at the publishing houses, they're like guys with eye shades on gambling. They gamble for a living. They're looking at, they really should wear the arm bands, and they're professional gamblers, and what they gamble on, they're betting on manuscripts and proposals they get. And if they buy a proposal that wins, they get to keep doing it. If you have enough losers, they're out of a job. And so media, so much of industry is highly speculative. The early days of Nike and Jordan, they had no idea it was going to blow up like that. And they had all these shoes. And then soon they had a dip in the sales of Air Jordan for a while. And that was when Phil Knight wanted to get rid of Michael. And all the henchmen at Nike had to go, no, don't get rid of Michael. You know, we just got to adjust to this. He's more powerful than all the college basketball stuff we have together. And so, you know, media was the original speculative industry. It was the original driver of economy. I mean, other than farming and, you know, the media arts are, and just as it was the heart of the Industrial Revolution with the printing press in Europe. And so, those are eternal truths. And Michael Jordan just had the perfect timing to walk right into the middle of those eternal truths.
We'll move on from Jordan for a moment, because I do want to talk about a couple of your writing influences that you submitted to us ahead of time, one of whom is David Halberstam.
Right. When I started my first basketball book, my first book, the first thing I did, I had a copy of The Best and the Brightest. David Halberstam's book about the Vietnam War. I was very aware of who David Halberstam was. I hadn't read all of The Best and the Brightest. It was a long friggin' book. but I'd read most of it, and I had a sense. And so when I said, well, I want to get into a little deeper understanding. And so I said, I'll start with David Halberstam, you know, and of course I would get to know him during the Last Dance season, during that great Indiana series. I had press seats on press row with David Halberstam. And then we would talk a lot. He was trying to write his book on Jordan that year. He did a magnificent biography, but he never got to talk to Jordan. And I was writing my book, Blood on the Horns, and I was going everywhere. And he's you know, he had a lot of baggage. Halberstam did, because he was David freaking Halberstam. You know, he couldn't just, I was just like some guy scurrying around, you know, some,
Cause that Vietnam book, was that he won a Pulitzer Prize for that? Did he? Cause I know he won it at some point.
He did. Well deserved. And so he couldn't, you know, I would do things like, I'm in Toronto and the locker room's packed and the Scotty and Michael are still in the shower. And I've been observing, and I know that Scotty's going to come out of the shower first. And sure enough, Scotty comes out, and like moss to a flame, the whole media crowd just literally pins him against the wall as he's headed across the locker room to start asking him about the game. They're all on deadline. Everything's precious. And I know that Michael's coming out not too long after him. And so I wait right there. I got my recorder. Mike comes out, and I have that one precious question I need to ask him as we walk across the locker room. And so I get that, and that's where, you know, he goes, you know, he looks at the question. And so suddenly we go to Dallas, and he gives me like 20 minutes one-on-one before the game. And then we're back in Chicago, and he gives me an hour on a Saturday outside after practice. Now, that question had gotten his attention. That question presented to me by Tex Winter. And so it was David Halberstam couldn't do that. It was not possible.
And that, sorry, Roland, that question that you're asking that got his attention, what was it? Or can you remember even the thrust of it?
I remember the question I asked got Phil Jackson's attention. He hit my line like a big old fat bass. You ever done any fishing?
No, I never have.
Well, if you ever fish, there's when the big fish smacks that line and is in. That's how Phil responded to the question I asked him. It was subtle. I asked him, Michael, I need to talk with you about your fierce humor and how you use that as a team leader to really police the roster. Because he was in the back of the bus after every game, humiliating everybody on the bus. And I was writing about that. Nobody knew that. I'd been tipped off to that. And so, I mean, just brutal humiliation. And the most brutal humiliation was aimed at Jerry Krause. Mm. And so when I did that, I, you know, that was the same thing. That was the bass hitting the line. Michael gave me the time. I was supposed to get 5 minutes with Phil Jackson 5 years earlier. And I asked him one question. And we talked for 2 hours. I went through every bit of cassette tape I had. This was in like 94, 95. And he just told me everything. He told me that he and Krause hated each other. Nobody knew that. He told me all this stuff just because of that one question. And you know how hard it is to get that question? I've done thousands of interviews. Of course, when you're interviewing Phil Jackson or Michael Jordan, you work really hard for that one question. But most of the time, we don't have the time and energy, the mental energy to find that question that's going to unlock. Some people are open books, such as myself. You ask me a question and I'm off running like a haywire pony. But most people have some reservation. They're not going to show their cards. And so a lot of times you have to really, and you know, a lot of it is they simply do so many interviews. They don't want to waste the time trying to tell people the same old stuff again.
And what are you trying to show people when you get this question? Like, are you trying to show you can trust me, or are you kind of provoking them in a sense like, I know more than you think I know, so it's time to take me seriously?
All of the above. It's also a sign of respect. You've done the work to know. You know things that others don't. I asked Phil Jackson about John Kunla. John Kunla won 6 championships with the Minneapolis Lakers back in the 1940s and 50s. And he had George Mikan and Jim Pollard, 2 Hall of Famers, great players. They dominated the NBA. And it took Kunla 40 years to get in the Hall of Fame. He coached six championship teams. He dominated the game. He was the pick and roll guy. Today, all you see is pick and roll. And Kunla was there, and it took him four decades. And I knew that Kunla had gone on to coach college, and he had recruited Phil Jackson as a young player out of North Dakota. And when I told Phil I wanted to ask him about John Kunla, he levitated out of the chair. It was like the classic moment of my life. Because when you are doing work as a writer, you are seeking the most powerful level of information you can find. And usually that power, it may be some big secret. A lot of times it's just human emotion. The details of very powerful human stories or very revealing things about people, the psychology of people who are in the target of the public eye. And I had two of those guys when I was writing about the Bulls. I had Michael Jordan and I had Phil Jackson, and they were both like, the public was like locked in on both of them.
And David Halberstam didn't have it.
He couldn't. They got him set up to get on the bus to talk to Michael, and Jerry Krause wouldn't let him on the bus. And the whole organization was in at war at that time. But David Halberstam very graciously used a lot of the stuff and quoted it and thanked me. And from my interviews for his book. But he did so much other research. You know, I learned so much as a writer from David Halberstam, a lot of times from reading his political works. And, I didn't think of myself really as a full biographer, but the other guy on the list, Robert Caro, with, you know, his biography of Lyndon Johnson, the multi-part biography. And one of the guys I left off and I shouldn't have is the multi-part biography of Martin Luther King, Parting the Waters, America in the King Years. And that guy, I can't believe I'm having a moment. He also did Bill Russell's autobiography with him, Second Wind. He's out of Baltimore. He's a great writer. Those biographers of, particularly Robert Caro and David Halberstam, those were the writers who affected deeply. In college, I loved Kurt Vonnegut. You know, Mark Twain, all those kinds of guys. We have a rich literature to draw from.
I'm going to out myself as a Philistine and say I've not really read any Kurt Vonnegut, but I have read, thanks to my deep research, your Twitter bio, and it says that Kurt Vonnegut taught you about time. Can you explain that?
Yeah, he had a classic book that became a film, Slaughterhouse-Five, about the firebombing of Dresden, told through the eyes of this goofy American prisoner of the Germans at the end of the war. But Kurt Vonnegut was a science fiction writer. And so he might be zipping all over the universe through time. And, you know, it really didn't matter. You could have everything out of sequence, but each of the vignettes you're presenting in a text, sort of like tiles in a mosaic. And Vonnegut did so many. He started as sort of a cheesy science fiction writer and became the lion of a generation. And he still maintained that cheesy kind of science fiction writer, but his books are so accessible. And you can read one in a day. I mean, pick up Player Piano or, Cat's Cradle or any of them, Slaughterhouse-Five, it's a heavy book. And they all are. They deal, you know, they deal with all sorts of things. But just being able to jump around a bit. When I'm doing these sports biographies, the editor sometimes get a little nervous with me because I'm sometimes I get into too much deep background. But I like for a basketball player's life to open the cultural window. Because we do such a shitty job of learning history. I won't blame it on the teachers. I will. We do such a shitty job in the world of teaching and learning history. And the only people who really present history to us well are filmmakers. And they lie about half of it. They just make up shit to make the drama, which is like Shakespeare. You know, it's fine. But I really do enjoy researching history firsthand and sort of getting it from the directly from official records and all of that stuff. And sometimes like in my projects, I can get off in the weeds a good bit, but I've done that some with my Magic Johnson book.
Yeah. I hope you don't mind me asking about this, but you were present firsthand for a bit of kind of the ugliest piece in modern American history at Virginia Tech, the shooting.
No, I was, yeah.
Yeah, can you maybe, like, if you don't mind me asking about this, can you maybe just tell us what happened? So this is, so a student called, is it Sung Hui Cho, was a student at the university. He killed 32 people and injured another 25. You were teaching a class that day. If you don't mind me asking, can I ask you to recount the
First of all, I taught 100 writing students a semester at Virginia Tech, and I did that for 11 years. And this was what was called media writing, basic journalism. And so I had a course that I designed based on my experience as a crime reporter. And all of the requirements of that. And so I was in the process. I'd take my students through I'd make up events, a lot of them from my experience, because you don't forget the stories, but it might be a barn fire that killed 6 horses. It might be a wreck that killed a 17-year-old kid a week before his 18th birthday. You just never knew. But and so these students would have to write them, and they'd screw it all up, and they wouldn't have any of the facts right. And I had to explain to them that you can say the kid was 18 when he died a week before he turned 18, and you're going to get a call from his mother, and she's going to say, "How could you say my son was 18? He never lived to be 18." And the reason I know that is because it happened to me. And so I had a pretty intense, but I made them rewrite and rewrite and rewrite until they got that story right. And they understood that the facts were more important than whatever they were trying to do with anything else related to it. And it taught the power of rewriting, but it taught the power, and right in the middle of this, well, at the start of the year, we'd had a killing on campus by a guy who went berserk, and it blew up. It was actually just off campus, but my students were in lockdown then. And I said, I really wish I'd gotten my students up off the floor, because when you go into lockdown, everybody gets under the tables. And I'd wish they'd started reporting. I'm teaching reporting. Damn it, I should have. You know, and so lo and behold, here comes this. One of my students was Asian, and Geraldo had reported and shown her boyfriend with an armload of rifles on his Zanga site. And so, and he was in the English department in our building. You know, he was an English major, and everybody in my class thought that her boyfriend was the killer. And I had a daughter, my oldest child was working in university relations for the news bureau. And I got a call like she called me and she was giving me updates, and she went, she called me about 10 minutes in and said, Dad, it's 32 black. I said, what? And so I had a group of terrorized kids.
And sorry, that means 32 people dead. Is that, that's the code of that your daughter's using?
Yeah, it was the code of emergency crews.
Yeah.
And so I got them up that I could. There were about four or five of them that were willing to get off the floor and get on the telephones and start calling hospitals. And we had a student website I'd created called Planet Blacksburg for them to do their news stories for this, but for their features and, you know, so that they would become published writers. And they were learning this, you know, this was 2007. They were learning web work and all of the attached things. They were doing video. And so there were four of them who could do it. Maybe five. And then we had some others who weren't in that particular class, but they were part of Planet Blacksburg and they would eventually come in. But so they started phoning hospitals and checking on official accounts of casualties and writing news stories and putting them on the web. And it didn't take long before Sky News and the BBC and news organizations from all over the globe were emailing and dialing on their cell phones my students to be sources for them to do interviews. And so, I mean, in a matter of minutes, and this is when Facebook was in a different form. In those days, you could sign up for a class, put your name in, and then you would see everybody on the class roll. And this is how smart my students were. They'd signed up for the classes where they figured the gunman had hit in certain buildings over there. And suddenly they were accessing witnesses and worse. And I mean, it happened. It spun around. It was just astounding how it went global.
So I hope you don't think that this is voyeuristic on my part, but like, you're in the classroom. Can you hear a gun going off? You're told
We are. And the bulk of this happened well after. If memory serves me, he started shooting early that morning. You know, 9 o'clock class. I haven't visited this information in a while. And I had a class that same hour, and he was probably 100 yards from where I was, 150. And we very quickly got a notice of it. University put us on a lockdown. And I was in phone contact with my daughter, who was in university relations. And so as this went on, the students could get up, they did their work. And after about 3 hours, the lockdown ended and students were told to go back to their dorms. But three of the students who had really worked, I had been a police reporter. I've been working around police forever. I've been to crime scenes. I just had so much experience in that. And so I got those three to go with me and we went over to the crime scene. And I'm just very experienced at talking to police officers and gaining access to crime scene, not going into the building, but being in the large roped off area where we could talk to people so that these students could report the story.
I'm amazed that your students reported it live from while they were locked down in the classroom. Was that
an amazing thing?
Like, was that a natural instinct on their part? Did you?
Because we had had that shooting at the start of the semester and I had just let them sit there in fear. I said after that, if it ever happened again, not thinking it ever would, that if it ever happened again, and that was at the start, that was like the first or second day of school, all the way in April 16th, that was, you know, 7-8 months later, we had this horrible situation. And I had some students who were very serious about being reporters and writers. And they went over there with me. And then they mainly used their visuals of watching the police officers coming, going, the very bitter wind. Blacksburg, Virginia is a place that can be very cold. You're from Ireland. I don't have to explain it. It can be very cold in the spring. And it was one of those bitter days. And so, yes, it all evolved from that.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't realize that there had actually been two separate shooting incidents that year. Like, Jesus Christ. And how did the students take to it? Like, they were obviously...
Three or four, maybe five got off the ground, got on the phones and were reporters. The others, you know, there were a lot of students in there to study public relations. They had to do the reporting work. But, you know, it takes a special person to want to be a reporter.
And then, sorry, my last question on this is, like, one of the girls in the class, like, there was a brief period when she thought her boyfriend was the gunman.
Right. Because Rivera put his website up. Geraldo on the news. And she had, I wasn't even aware of this. She had let it, you know, the students were all aware of it. I wasn't, but there were some of them that were scared to death, understandably.
Yeah. And if you don't mind me asking, can you take me into your headspace that evening when you're home and you, like, everyone you know is safe and secure and you're reflecting on the day?
Late that night I got home. It was, I'll just put it this way. It's like somebody just suddenly hijacks you, puts you in a rocket ship and shoots you off into some universe that you, parallel universe that you never expected. And it's bizarre and one thing leads to another and we're doing this oral history of the moment. That was, I had done all kinds of hard interviews. I've covered a lot of stuff in my life. I've seen a lot of stuff as a crime reporter. And I was sort of inured to it. I mean, you can't be inured to 32 people murdered. But I mean, the process of being a police reporter, and there was just a hardcore group that was really a group of, and the same was true of the student newspaper that was operated partly out of our communication department, and a lot of our students wrote for it. They were doing the same thing. They were working around the clock on this story. They, you know, it was like any college is sort of an enclave. It's insular. And so reporters can descend from all over the globe, and satellite trucks, but they really don't know the character. And a lot of times the students are the ones who articulate all of that.
Yeah. And they have done in a book that you edited, April 16th, Virginia Tech Remembers. How was it a difficult decision to put that book together? Did you get any criticism for doing it, or did it always feel like the right thing to do?
Why would you not get criticism for doing that? I mean, it was really my agent at the time. You know, I was doing this work. I didn't, and he came up with the idea, and I sort of said, you know, I didn't know. I hadn't had time to think it out. I was dealing with this stuff, and usually it takes a while to, I mean, just overnight they announced we were doing the book, and I was like, and he had a New York publisher, and it was a paperback contract. It paid the students rent and their money, and it paid all the students for the student newspaper to contribute things. but it was the biggest, most profoundly difficult thing of my life, and also for them. It was a very difficult thing. We had to interview all the people, and people wanted to talk. We didn't ask them for interviews. We simply sent a directive that if you want to talk about this, and so they talked about it, and we worked on it from April to I don't know, the end of June. And then it went into production and came out.
How do you reflect when you see the book on the shelf now? How do you reflect on it? Is there pride? Is there maybe there's no simple emotion to attach to it?
There's no way to even describe that. I read it for the first time in about 10, 12 years. A while back, I read part of it. Obviously, I had to spend a lot of time with all of it. Because I wasn't just sending them to do interviews. I would go with them. And we had an agreement that we would vote secretly when it was done if we were going to publish it. And anonymously, no one would know. And if any one of our group, I think we had about 11 involved by then. If any one of the groups said, no, we don't want to publish this. What we would have done is just archived it at the library and made it available. And no one voted against it. I was this close to just saying, let's archive it. The publication of the book itself, it was not a big seller or anything. The publication of the book itself really didn't matter. The process is what was so profound. It was really to get into that. I explained it was like the shattered emotions of everyone there, all in shards. And we were picking up all the broken pieces of all these emotions and, again, back to a mosaic, putting them back together there.
This is the 50th episode of this show. That is one of the most extraordinary stories that we've heard told across, well, more than 50 hours at this point. So thank you very much for sharing it. Any of those students, have they become reporters, by the way? Or
did they end up going?
They've gone on to various jobs in media. Also, from the group of students we had, the people writing for the student newspaper, their work was included. And a couple of them worked in the film industry, and several others became reporters.
What a story. We're pretty much out of time, Roland. We finish up this podcast by asking two stock questions to everyone, because it allows me to trick the listener to thinking I've put any kind of shape on these conversations. So I'm gonna throw them both at you. And you may already have made reference to him at the Chicago Bulls, but who is the most interesting person you've met with work?
Oh, I don't know. I used to make my students go do interviews. And there, one time, one of these students brought back this interview with a 45-year-old woman who was up in, I live in the Blue Ridge Mountains, and further up in the mountains, there's this little mountain town, Floyd, Virginia. And the Floyd Press had this woman who wrote features. And her answers to these questions were absolutely profound, and the care she took and her approach to writing the features. And it was, I mean, I've had students, and in addition to my own work, I've had the great run of interviewing, you know, we've been digitizing 40 years of audio tape interviews I've done. A film producer has bought the rights to them all for documentary stuff. And so I've had the run at that. But I, you know, the thing that really struck me of all this was that student interview with this person who's probably making about $12,000 a year, working as a feature writer, who just obviously had it all right, was doing great work, was well-read, and was just in this little paper in this mountain town. So that is one I remember.
And finally, the most interesting place the work has brought you?
I would say Italy, but Chicago. In the early days, when Chicago's stadium was there, and it was in a really hard part of Chicago then. This was before all the area became gentrified and rebuilt. And so you really took your life in your own hands parking around there. I mean, it was – and so Chicago Stadium, some of the spots in L.A., I've enjoyed the NBA cities. Vancouver used to be like going to basketball games on the moon. It was so far away from everything else when it was in British Columbia. Yeah. So it's all been good. I've had a great life.
Yeah, watching Michael Jordan play basketball, I mean, you often thought that maybe there are similar levels of gravity in both places. Roland Lazenby, thank you so much. That was a real pleasure.
Thank you. It's a great interview. I got to let my dog out. She's going to pee in here.
She's perfect.
Ringing that bell like crazy.
Thank you very much to Roland. And thanks again to you for listening and supporting Behind the Lines. Here is to another half century of episodes, and we're going to start on that next week when we will be back with another great guest. But until then, take it easy.